Conservative Georgia Congressman Newt Gingrich complained about the ad campaign. He should have been running against liberals and radicals. Reagan won nearly 60% of the popular vote in every state but Minnesota, his opponent Walter Mondale's home state. Mondale won the District of Columbia. In 1985, the United States and the USSR together held a stockpile of more than 60,000 warheads. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev began pursuing a policy of glasnost, opening the society, and perestroika, restructuring the Soviet Union's collapsed economy. Keen to limit defense spending, he agreed to a series of arms limitation talks beginning in Geneva. The talks stalled, but plainly Gorbachev's position had drastically weakened. The Cold War had lasted nearly half a century. It had been terrible and terrifying. It had lasted so long that it had been nearly impossible to imagine that it would ever end. And when it did, when communism began collapsing across the Soviet bloc, it began to look to many Americans as if Ronald Reagan, with a strong hand and an iron will, had saved the nation and even the world. The fall of communism liberated Eastern Europe. It also unleashed an unregulated capitalism that would widen economic inequality, destabilize the world order, and eventually threaten America's place in that order. There were precedents for changes on so epic a scale. Capitalism had been unregulated before at the end of the 19th century, only to be subject to regulation once more during the Progressive Era and the New Deal. Empires and nations and ideologies had risen and fallen before, too, as during the Second World War, when a new order had emerged in its aftermath. But if Americans contemplating the consequences of the fall of communism and the end of the Cold War were wise to look to the past to anticipate the future, they were unable to imagine the revolution in information technology that would resist regulation and undermine efforts to establish a new political order. Reagan, having stockpiled his political capital, set about restructuring the judiciary. Originalism was one strategy for turning back decisions made by the liberal Warren Court. Another strategy was to replace liberal justices with conservative ones, beginning with lower court appointments. While campaigning, Reagan had pledged to appoint only family values judges. Liberals read this as coded language meaning white and Christian. Edwin Meese handled the selection of 369 district and appeals court judges, more than had been appointed by any other president. Of those 369 judges, only 22 were non-white. By the time Reagan left office, his appointees constituted nearly half of all the judges on federal courts. In 1982, Reagan appointed University of Chicago law professor Antonin Scalia to the D.C. Court. 4 years later, he named him to the Supreme Court. A member of the Federalist Society, Scalia, a father of nine, was also a devout Catholic. Scalia became the Supreme Court's most learned and eloquent proponent of originalism. Between judges interpreting the Constitution and judges trying to figure out what the framers meant, he argued, originalism was plainly the lesser evil. The purpose of constitutional guarantees is precisely to prevent the law from reflecting certain changes in original values that the society adopting the Constitution thinks fundamentally undesirable, Scalia wrote. Scalia joined the court in 1986, just after it issued a landmark 5-4 decision in Bowers v. Hardwick, refusing to overturn a ban on sodomy in Georgia. The gay rights movement had grown during the 1980s in the face of a public health crisis. AIDS as a disease was first identified in 1981. HIV was isolated in 1984. By 1989, the CDC confirmed that AIDS had infected 82,764 Americans and killed 46,344, and estimated that 10 times as many cases of infection had not yet been reported. 3 out of 4 cases in the 1980s were gay men. As some leaders of the Christian Coalition called the disease God's vengeance, Pat Buchanan said, "Nature is exacting an awful retribution." Reagan kept silent. He didn't speak publicly about AIDS until 1985, when he responded to a question about the disease at a press conference. And still, the federal government offered scant support for research and public health services. Bowers had been part of a legal campaign to decriminalize homosexuality by building on the right to privacy established in the chain of cases that began with Griswold versus Connecticut. The court rejected this argument. No connection between family marriage or procreation on the one hand and homosexual activity on the other hand has been demonstrated. Therefore, the case turned not on a right to privacy, but on the claim of a fundamental right to engage in homosexual sodomy, which the court determined did not exist. Justice Lewis Powell, who joined the majority, said to one of his clerks at the time, I don't believe I've ever met a homosexual. Unknown to Powell, that clerk, as well as several of Powell's earlier clerks, was a closeted gay man. Justice Harry Blackmun, dissenting, argued that the case did indeed turn on a right to privacy. If that right means anything, it means that before Georgia can prosecute its citizens for making choices about the most intimate aspects of their lives, it must do more than assert that the choice they have made is an abominable crime not fit to be named among Christians. Liberal legal scholars and jurists had long been frustrated with the right to privacy as a constitutional argument with which to understand rights having to do with women, sexuality, and the family. In Griswold, Roe, and Bowers, amicus briefs submitted on behalf of the plaintiffs by organizations that included the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, and the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund made arguments based on equality that the court simply ignored, instead choosing to base its opinion in these cases on privacy. After the deadline for ratifying the ERA expired in 1982, it appeared that women and gay men would be granted not equality, but at best, privacy. A right to privacy looks like an injury got up as a gift, the controversial feminist legal theorist Catherine MacKinnon argued in 1983. In 1985, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, then on the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C., regretted that the Supreme Court had treated reproductive autonomy under a substantive due process personal autonomy headline not expressly linked to discrimination against women. Ginsburg found the court's opinion in Roe wanting for a number of reasons, but among them was its failure to pay any attention at all to discrimination against women or to a woman's ability to stand in relation to man, society, and the state as an independent, self-sustaining, equal citizen. Privacy arguments, long troubling to feminists, were especially troubling to gay rights activists, who, especially given the Reagan administration's seeming indifference to the staggering suffering endured during the AIDS crisis, insisted on the importance and the urgency of visibility, of pride, and of coming out. Silence equals death was the slogan of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, which protested in Washington in 1987. The gay rights movement, facing the pro-family rhetoric of the right and observing the limits of the right to privacy in reproductive rights cases, changed course. During the 1990s, privacy remained the watchword of the reproductive rights movement, and abortion became more hidden and more difficult to procure, while equality became the watchword of the gay rights movement, especially after the anti-discrimination fight to overturn anti-sodomy laws turned into an equal rights fight for same-sex marriage. Each of these battles over sex and reproduction cast light on a disagreement on the Supreme Court over the place of historical analysis in constitutional interpretation. In Bowers, Justice Byron White, writing for the majority, argued that the right to engage in homosexual sex was not rooted in tradition. Instead, prohibitions on homosexual sex were rooted in tradition. These prohibitions, he said, have ancient roots. I cannot say that conduct condemned for hundreds of years has now become a fundamental right, Justice Powell wrote in a concurring opinion. Justice Blackmun argued against this use of history. I cannot agree that either the length of time a majority has held its conviction or the passions with which it defends them can withdraw legislation from this court's scrutiny. The place of originalism in American jurisprudence reached the attention of the public in 1987, during the bicentennial of the Constitutional Convention and the explosive debate over the nomination of Robert Bork. That May, Justice Thurgood Marshall, the distinguished elder statesman of the civil rights movement, gave a speech in which he suggested that the celebration of the bicentennial invites a complacent belief that the vision of those who debated and compromised in Philadelphia yielded to the more perfect union it is said we now enjoy. Marshall, who had spent the first half of his career fighting against Plessy v. Ferguson, raised a sharp eyebrow at the then-popular Dewey nostalgia for the 1787 Constitution and the pieties of originalists. I cannot accept this invitation, for I do not believe that the meaning of the Constitution was forever fixed at the Philadelphia Convention, Marshall said, with as firm a conviction as he had argued before the court in Brown v. Board. Nor do I find the wisdom, foresight, and sense of justice exhibited by the framers particularly profound. To the contrary, the government they devised was defective from the start. Weeks after Marshall's cry of dissent, Reagan nominated Bork to the bench. The best-known conservative legal theorist in the nation, he had been promised a seat by Nixon after the Saturday Night Massacre. His nomination had been strongly supported by the Federalist Society. Bork had a singularly narrow view of constitutional interpretation. No fundamental rights exist outside of those listed in the Constitution, he argued. Original intent is the only legitimate basis for constitutional decision, he'd written. And although as late as 1989, Bork would argue that the Second Amendment works to guarantee the rights of states to form militias, not for individuals to bear arms, he did not believe that the right to privacy established in Griswold existed, and instead believed that privacy had become an unstructured source of judicial power. Before Bork, Supreme Court nominations had been all but automatically and often unanimously approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee. The bipartisanship and deference to the separation of powers that such approval represented ended with Bork. Less than an hour after Reagan announced his nominee, Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy delivered a speech in the Senate in which he declared, "Robert Bork's America is a land in which women will be forced to back-alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, rogue police could break down a citizen's doors in midnight raids, schoolchildren could not be taught about evolution, writers and artists could be censored at the whim of the government, and the doors of the federal courts would be shut on the fingers of millions of citizens." Apocalyptic rhetoric had pervaded American politics from the start. After all, supporters of John Adams had warned that to elect Thomas Jefferson would be to live in a world without God. But with Bork's nomination, the language of the end of days came to the courts, as if justice itself had become a kind of dystopia. Not all of the campaign against Bork was as full-throated as Kennedy's speech. Gregory Peck, best known for his portrayal of an anti-lynching lawyer in To Kill a Mockingbird, provided the narration for a temperate television ad that alerted Americans to Bork's support for poll taxes and literacy tests and his opposition to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and urged them to call their senators to ask them to oppose Bork's nomination. Still, the extraordinary fact was that a judicial nomination had elicited paid political advertising at all, and the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings themselves, also aired on television, proved far from temperate. The televised Bork hearings offered Americans a sweeping survey of the nation's history and an argument over it. Bork, with a frizz of combed-over red and gray hair and a grizzled beard, parried with the senators on subjects ranging from free speech to women's rights. He quoted Benjamin Franklin's remarks from the closing day of the Constitutional Convention. He talked about and answered questions on black codes, the committee that drafted the 14th Amendment, Plessy v. Ferguson, Brown v. Board, and Griswold v. Connecticut. The Connecticut law banning contraception was nutty, Bork told the committee, but the court's decision in Griswold was worse. It comes out of nowhere, and it doesn't have any rooting in the Constitution. He talked about the ERA and about Bowers, about originalism and liberalism. In the end, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted down his nomination, 58-42. 5 months after Bork's nomination was rejected, he spoke at the annual meeting of the Federalist Society, where members of the audience wore buttons that read, "Reappoint Bork." To Bork became a verb, meaning to destroy a judicial nomination through political campaigning. Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition promised that conservatives would one day Bork back. Battle lines between the left and the right had been inked on the very pages of the Constitution itself. The lines were new, but the questions were old. They had been debated by every generation of Americans. Are women persons? Is separate equal? What is the role of the state in protecting its citizens against discrimination? Is discrimination based on race different from discrimination based on gender or sexuality? Are there limits to free speech? The Bork hearings, and more broadly, the realignment of the Supreme Court and the politicization of the nomination process, marked a turn towards what, in the 1850s, William Seward had called an irrepressible conflict. Its importance was second only to the other lasting legacy of the Reagan era, Reagan's role in bringing about the end of the Cold War. Tragically, the fall of communism, the defeat of an enemy abroad, would only gird Americans for the battle to come with one another at home. In the last quarter of the 20th century, rising global temperatures replaced the possibility of nuclear Armageddon as the chief threat to the planet. Climate change shaped U.S. foreign policy and its domestic agenda, too. But it also manifested itself as yet another kind of partisan division. Conservatives rejected the science of climate change and added environmental science to the list of institutions like the press and the courts that could not be trusted because of their liberal bias. In June 1987, Reagan, visiting Berlin, demanded, "Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate! Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall!" Months later, the two leaders signed an agreement to destroy intermediate and short-range missiles. The Berlin Wall, a once towering symbol of Soviet power and communist repression, fell in 1989, reduced to rubble. Gorbachev was forced out of office in 1991, but by then, the Soviet empire had collapsed. By 1992, more than four decades after it began, the Cold War, unimaginably, was over. Missile by missile, the silos began to close, their caves abandoned. The skies cleared, and the oceans rose. 3. Between the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the global war on terror, Americans dragged themselves bloody and bruised from one political skirmish to the next. They fought over guns, abortion, religion, gay rights, and the environment. They fought in the schools, the courts, the press, and the university. They fought with words, and they fought over words. They fought by tooth and by nail and by hook and by crook, and they believed they were fighting for the meaning of America, but really, they were fighting for raw political power. One set of hatreds gives way to the next, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote wearily. By no means were all Americans animated by ideology. In fact, not very many were. But those who thought ideologically exerted disproportionate influence over American political culture. In their terms, political opponents were no longer mere partisans, equally loyal to the United States. They were enemies of the state. Conservatives, having lost anti-communism as a unifying ideology, leaned more on another, closer to home, opposition to liberalism. There's no after the Cold War for me, Irving Kristol announced in 1993. So far from having ended, my Cold War has increased in intensity, as sector after sector of American life has been ruthlessly corrupted by the liberal ethos. Liberals engaged in the politics of grievance and contempt. Anyone who disagreed with them was racist, sexist, classist, or homophobic, and stupid. On college campuses, they passed hate speech codes, banning speech that they deemed offensive. They would brook no dissent. Everyone seemed to be fighting, somehow, over women, who could not be made to fit into the Constitution, but could not be left out of it. Patrick Buchanan, Nixon's former speechwriter, declared war. Buchanan had been fired by Ford, but hired by Reagan as his director of communications. At the 1992 Republican National Convention, having lost the party's nomination to George H.W. Bush, he used his endorsement of Bush to rally the party's conservative wing by attacking the Democratic nominee, Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, and his two-for-the-price-of-one wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, who, campaigning for change, would become the focus of a deep and ugly public animus. This, my friends, this is radical feminism, the agenda that Clinton and Clinton would impose on America, Buchanan said, waving anti-feminism as a party flag. Abortion on demand, a litmus test for the Supreme Court, homosexual rights, discrimination against religious schools, women in combat units. That's change, all right, but that's not the kind of change America needs. It's not the kind of change America wants, and it's not the kind of change we can abide in a nation we still call God's country. The crowd chanted, "Go, Pat, go." To many on the right, Bill Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton represented the 1960s coming of age. Bork called them the very personification of the 60s generation, arrived at early middle age with its ideological baggage intact. A backlash against feminism animated much of the Christian right's pro-family crusade, and Hillary Rodham Clinton proved an easy target. She would remain a target for decades, not only during the campaign and not only during her husband's presidency, but through her later career in the Senate and as Secretary of State and during her own two bids for the presidency, and especially during her ill-fated campaign in 2016 against Donald Trump. Hillary Rodham, an astute, uncompromising, and no-nonsense Midwesterner, was born in Chicago in 1947. She started out as a Republican. A precocious politician, Rodham canvassed for Nixon when she was 13. At 17, she was a Goldwater girl. In 1965, she brought her copy of Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative to Wellesley, where she was elected president of the Young Republicans. As a Capitol Hill intern in 1968, Clinton attended the Republican National Convention in Miami. But her opposition to the war, along with her feminism, slowly drove her away from the GOP. Like many feminists, she began to drift away from the Republican Party when the party began to abandon its support for equal rights for women. In 1969, as president of her class at Wellesley, she became the first student invited to deliver a commencement address. Her speech was featured in Life. In 1970, she spoke to the League of Women Voters on the occasion of its 50th anniversary, wearing a black armband, mourning the students shot by the National Guard at Kent State. The next year, she met Bill Clinton when they were both students at Yale Law School. After graduating, she moved to Washington, D.C. She worked as a staffer for the special counsel that was preparing for the possibility of a Nixon impeachment. The next year, she married Clinton and kept her name. In 1982, in the interest of her husband's political career, she began referring to herself as Hillary Rodham Clinton. The Republican Party was losing women fast. But the Democratic Party that Hillary Clinton joined in 1972 was undergoing a transformation too, one unprecedented in the 20th century. It was willfully kicking its base out from under it. Since the rise of William Jennings Bryan in 1896, the Democratic Party had been the party of labor. But early in the 1970s, while the Republican Party was courting blue-collar white men, especially men who'd lost their manufacturing jobs, the Democratic Party began abandoning blue-collar union workers, especially white men, in favor of a coalition of women, minorities, and what had come to be called knowledge workers, engineers, scientists, and analysts who wore white collars and tapped away at desktop computers at technology firms, universities, consulting firms, and banks. Fatefully, the Democratic Party made a bid to become not the party of labor, but the party of knowledge. Party leaders, enthralled by the emerging high-tech industry, placed their faith in machines to drive demographic and political change. After the end of the Second World War, with a decline of industrial production, knowledge workers had become the fastest-growing occupational sector. Cold War-era government-funded science and technology projects created a civilian offshoot. Technology firms grew like weeds in the suburban peripheries of university-rich cities like Boston, New York, New Haven, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Chicago, Seattle, Los Angeles, Ann Arbor, Madison, Austin, Boulder, Chapel Hill, and San Francisco. If small in number, liberals who lived in the suburbs and worked in technology had an outsized influence on the Democratic Party. They favored and lavishly funded the campaigns of other highly educated liberals, from George McGovern in 1972 to Michael Dukakis in 1988 to John Kerry in 2004, campaigns that failed miserably. The new Democrats' understanding of the world was technocratic, meritocratic, and therapeutic. They believed that technology could fix political, social, and economic problems, and yet they also believed that they owed their own success to their talents and drive, and that people who had achieved less were less talented and driven. They tended not to see how much of their lives had been shaped by government policies, like government-funded research, or the zoning laws and restrictive covenants that had created high-quality schools in the all-white suburbs, or the occasional swank urban pockets in which they typically lived. Notwithstanding all the ways in which government assistance had made possible the conditions of their lives and work, they tended to be opposed to government assistance. Believing in individual achievement and the power of the self, they saw the different political advantages of other people, especially of people who had achieved less, as personal, psychological failings. Racism, for instance, they saw not as a structural problem, but as a prejudice born of ignorance. Some of the attitudes of this political class lay in the mystique surrounding the personal computer. Big IBM machines and punch card computing had looked to the new left, bureaucratic, organizational, and inhuman. Students were cogs in the machine of the university. Draftees were cogs in the war machine, itself figured as a computer. A 1964 free speech activist demonstrating at Berkeley had strung around their necks punch cards that read, "I am a UC student. Please do not fold, bend, spindle, or mutilate me." Personal computing, a rejection of those punch cards, came out of the 1960s Bay Area counterculture, a rage against the IBM machine. Its loudest promoter was Stuart Brand, who had joined Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters after graduating from Stanford and founded the Whole Earth Catalog in 1967 in Menlo Park for the tens of thousands of people who are dropping out and moving back to the land, living in communes, and for the much bigger number of people who dreamed of dropping out. The 1971 Whole Earth Catalog won the National Book Award and sold 2.5 million copies. It peddled everything from copies of Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom for $1.50 to parts for an old Volkswagen to a do-it-yourself burial for $50 to instructions on how to build a working digital computer for $4.45. "A realm of intimate personal power is developing," Brand wrote. "Power of the individual to conduct his own education, find his own inspiration, shape his own environment, and share his adventure with whoever is interested." For Brand and these new communalists, dropping out meant plugging in. Mind and consciousness, sun and soil, monitor and keyboard. In 1967, one Haight-Ashbury poet handed out a poem that began, "I like to think, and the sooner the better, of a cybernetic meadow where mammals and computers live together in mutually programming harmony like pure water touching clear sky." Not irrelevantly, the same group of people, whole earth hippies, usually had quite traditional ideas about the role of women. In the 1960s and 1970s, on back-to-the-land communes where people read Brand's Whole Earth Catalog and imagined they were living on an American frontier, Women baked bread and spun wool and breastfed and saved seeds. Brand was interested in planetary thinking, the whole Earth, and imagined a worldwide network of computers bringing the world's peoples together in perfect harmony. That required first personal computers, one per person. In 1968, Brand helped produce the mother of all demos at a computer industry conference in San Francisco to demonstrate a prototype of a personal computer that Kesey later pronounced the next thing after acid. Brand wrote about computing for Rolling Stone in 1972. Ready or not, computers are coming to the people. Bill Gates and Paul Allen, who met as boys in Seattle, founded Microsoft in 1975, later adopting the motto, a personal computer on every desk. In Cupertino, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak founded Apple Computer in 1976 and released the Apple II the next year. By 1980, Apple's IPO broke a record held by the Ford Motor Company since 1956. By the 1990s, wealthy Silicon Valley entrepreneurs would lead a Democratic Party that had restructured itself around their priorities. Beginning in 1972, the DNC instituted quotas for its delegations, requiring numbers of women, minorities, and youth, but establishing no quotas for union members or the working class. The new rules made it possible for affluent professionals to take over the party, a change of course much influenced by longtime Democratic strategist Frederick Dutton's Changing Sources of Power, 1971. Dutton argued that the future of the party was young professionals, not old union members. Colorado Senator Gary Hart in 1974 took to mocking Eleanor Roosevelt Democrats as fusty and old-fashioned, not hip to the young computer people. The press called Hart's constituency Atari Democrats. Personal computing enthusiasts like to invoke the power of the people, but they meant the power of the individual person, fortified with a machine. Republicans, the party of big business, remained closely associated with IBM. Democrats, the party of the people, attached themselves to Apple and jettisoned people without the means or interests in owning their own computer. The knowledge worker, not auto worker wing of the party tried to move to the center under the auspices of the Democratic Leadership Council, founded in 1985 and soon joined by Bill Clinton and Al Gore. Calling themselves the New Democrats, they blamed Carter's defeat in 1980 and Mondale's defeat in 1984 on their support for unions and their old-fashioned New Deal liberalism. Thanks to the near-miraculous capabilities of microelectronics, we are vanquishing scarcity, an article in the DLC's New Democrat announced in 1995. The class politics of scarcity were dying, and in this new bright age of the microchip, there would be a politics of plenty in which the people left behind, the losers who cannot or will not participate in the knowledge economy, will be like illiterate peasants in the age of steam. The party stumbled like a drunken man, delirious with technological utopianism. Bill Clinton, 46 when he entered the White House and gone already gray, stood 6'2". He had a grin like a 1930s comic strip scamp, the cadence of a Southern Baptist preacher, and the husky voice of a blues singer. He'd grown up poor in Hope, Arkansas, the boy from Hope, and he climbed his way to the White House by dint of charm and hard work and good luck. During the Vietnam War, he dodged the draft. After a Rhodes Scholarship and an education at Yale Law School, he'd begun a career in politics with his young wife at his side. Like many a president before and since, he liked to be liked, and he yearned to be admired. Although unlike most presidents, Clinton wore his neediness on his face. He had all his life the face of a boy. He was only 32 in 1978 when he was elected governor of Arkansas. He appeared to serve as a bridge between the old Democrats and the new Democrats. A white Southerner from a humble background, he appealed to the party's old base. An Ivy League-educated progressive with a strong record on civil rights, he appealed to the party's new base. And yet he was all along a rascal. In 1992, Clinton's campaign for the Democratic nomination had nearly been felled by his reputation as a philanderer. After allegations of one extramarital affair hit the tabloids, he and his wife appeared on 60 Minutes, sitting together stiffly, and he admitted to causing pain in my marriage. Citing his right to privacy, he refused to directly answer any questions about infidelity. He also suggested that his candidacy offered an opportunity for the press to turn away from salaciousness. The year before, the battle for the courts had met the battle of the sexes during the Senate confirmation hearings of Bush's Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. In 1987, Thurgood Marshall, asked at a conference about the increasingly conservative nature of the court, said, Don't worry, I'm going to outlive those bastards. But suffering from glaucoma, hearing loss, and other ailments, Marshall retired from the court in 1991. To replace him, Bush nominated Thomas, whom he'd earlier appointed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. During the confirmation hearings, law professor Anita Hill accused Thomas, her former boss, of sexual harassment. The televised hearings had included graphic details. Despite Hill's powerful, damning testimony, the Senate confirmed Thomas. A year later, Clinton attempted to deflect inquiries about his alleged years-long affair with a woman named Jennifer Flowers by piously suggesting that public discourse had been demeaned by television hearings, proposing to elevate it by refusing to provide details. "This will test the character of the press," Clinton said on 60 Minutes. "It's not only my character that has been tested." The claim lacked the merest plausibility, not least because on other occasions, Clinton had been perfectly willing to discuss matters that other presidential candidates and officeholders would have scorned as demeaning to the dignity of the office. Asked by a high school student at an MTV-sponsored event in 1994 whether he wore boxers or briefs, for instance, he'd not hesitated to supply an answer, usually briefs. Clinton's two terms in office frustrated the left, enraged the right, and ended in scandal. He won the 1992 election with the lowest popular vote, 43%, since Woodrow Wilson. He set as his first task health care reform, which had been on the progressive docket for nearly a century. "If I don't get health care done, I'll wish I didn't run for president," he said. He handed this initiative over to his wife, assigning her to head the task force on national health care reform and calling her his Bobby Kennedy. Before her husband took office, Hillary Rodham Clinton, a chronic over-preparer, read 43 biographies of presidential wives to equip herself for the role. After the administration's first 100 days, Vanity Fair, in a profile of the First Lady, described her as holding unprecedented political ambitions. The magazine reported, "As the first working mother in the White House, the first unapologetic feminist, and arguably the most important woman in the world, she wants not just to have it all, but to do it all." She also changed her name again, going by Hillary Clinton. 6 weeks after Hillary Clinton moved into the White House, Betty Ford came to visit. But Hillary Clinton was no Betty Ford. She had more senior staff assigned to her than did Vice President Al Gore. Hillary Clinton's task force eventually produced a 1,342-page proposal for what was mainly employer-paid health care. Insurance companies and conservative policy groups, in a rerun of the Whitaker and Baxter campaign of 1949, spent hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising and lobbying campaigns to defeat the proposal. One series of ads featured a couple, Harry and Louise, regretting their lack of choice under health care plans designed by government bureaucrats, and closed, "Know the facts." Bill Kristol, like his father before him, a prominent conservative writer and strategist, urged Republicans to refuse any deal on health care in order to make the case to the public that democratic welfare state liberalism remains firmly in retreat. Conservatives likely also feared that if the Democrats succeeded in passing health care, its popularity would make the Democratic Party unstoppable. The First Lady, still a neophyte in the Capitol, urged her husband to make no compromises. In his 1994 State of the Union address, he promised to veto any bill that did not provide for universal coverage. By the midterm elections, when Republicans took over Congress, winning majorities in both houses for the first time in decades, the proposal, much derided for its intricacies and hobbled by conservatives' distaste for the president's wife, had failed. Felled by the unyielding partisanship of a new political culture, it never even reached a vote. The failure of Clinton's health care proposal crippled his presidency. His lasting legacy as a liberal came in 1993 when he appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court. But Clinton, who had more millionaires in his cabinet even than Bush had, moved to the right, even before the midterms, and much of his agenda amounted to a continuation of work begun by Reagan and Bush. He secured the ratification of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, against the opposition of labor unions. He took up the war on drugs waged by Nixon in 1971 and continued by Reagan with the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act. In 1994, the year Newt Gingrich issued a conservative contract with America, Clinton signed a new crime bill that lengthened mandatory sentencing and instituted a 100-to-1 ratio between sentences for possession of crack and of cocaine. The bill also included an assault weapons ban set to expire after 10 years. Some members of the Congressional Black Caucus, CBC, supported the bill. Others did not. The NAACP called it a crime against the American people. The CBC attempted to introduce a Racial Justice Act to include provisions relating to racial discrimination in sentencing. Republicans threatened to filibuster. When the crime bill passed, liberals boasted about becoming tough on crime. "The liberal wing of the Democratic Party is for 100,000 cops," announced Joe Biden, a hard-bitten senator who grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania. "The liberal wing of the Democratic Party is for 125,000 new state prison cells." These bipartisan measures contributed to a social catastrophe, an era of mass incarceration in which nearly one in every 100 American adults are in prison, the highest rate virtually anywhere in the world and four times the world average. The 1994 crime bill didn't cause that rise, which had begun much earlier, and in any case, most people in prison are not convicted of federal crimes. Their convictions follow state laws. But the federal crime bill, changes in state and local prosecution rates, and especially the new sentencing regime, made the problem worse. Two-thirds of the rise in the prison population between 1985 and 2000 involved drug convictions. The overwhelming majority of Americans convicted of drug offenses are black men. "The drug war is the new Jim Crow," read a poster stapled to a telephone booth in California, an observation with which social scientists came, painfully, to agree. Clinton struck deals on drugs, crimes, and guns because he believed in compromise and bipartisanship, but also because he liked and needed to be liked. Especially after the embarrassment of his health care proposal, he moved still further from the center. His political compromises on welfare and the regulation of the economy proved as consequential as his crime bill. In 1996, Clinton and his band of meritocratic New Democrats found common cause with conservatives, led by House Speaker Gingrich, in realizing his campaign pledge to end welfare as we know it. Siding with those who described welfare as trapping people in poverty through dependence on the government, his administration abolished aid for families with dependent children. Under the new regime, welfare was left up to the states. Clinton vetoed a Republican version of the bill that would have ended guaranteed health care to the poor through Medicaid. In 1999, in another abdication of the New Deal with far-reaching effects, Clinton signed a measure repealing elements of the Glass-Steagall Act, passed in 1933. The repeal lifted a ban on combinations between commercial and investment banks. Larry Summers, Clinton's Treasury Secretary, boasted, "At the end of the 20th century, we will at last be replacing an archaic set of restrictions with a legislative foundation for a 21st century financial system." The freewheeling securities industry saw record profits in the wake of the repeal. By the end of the decade, the average CEO of a big company earned nearly 400 times as much as the average worker. And not long after that, in 2008, during a global financial collapse, Summers' 21st century financial system would be revealed as having been cracked from the start. Long before the Atari Democrats' financial system failed, and notwithstanding Bill Clinton's forced grin centrism, the center would not hold. The heated rhetoric of the gun rights and anti-abortion movements fanned rage among extremists, and a new kind of politics came to characterize those on both the left and the right. Identity politics, by other names, goes all the way back to the founding of the Republic. The Constitution, which, for purposes of representation, counted some Americans as worth three-fifths of other Americans, rested on a politics of identity, white supremacy. "This government was made by our fathers on the white basis," Stephen Douglas had said, debating Abraham Lincoln. "It was made by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever." Lincoln, of course, had disagreed. There is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, he'd answered. "I hold that he is as much entitled to those as the white man." Overthrowing Stephen Douglas's brand of identity politics, the identity politics of slaveholders and later of the Klan and of immigration restrictionists, had been the work of more than a century of struggle for abolition, for emancipation, for suffrage and civil rights. Another self-described identity politics emerged in the middle of the 20th century out of the Black Power movement and the Gay Pride movement, and especially out of feminism. The term was coined in 1977 in a manifesto written by a collective of black lesbian feminists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. "The most profound and potentially most radical politics come directly out of our own identity as opposed to working to end somebody else's oppression," they wrote. Earlier in the 20th century, political change from the left had come from coalitions of farmers and laborers. In the 1970s, as animus toward immigrants rose, ethnic groups that had been subjected to longstanding discrimination, including Chicanos, Native Americans, and Asian Americans, found political solidarity, both within and across groups, by emphasizing their difference, not, as with the older identity politics, as racially superior, but as particularly and distinctively oppressed. By the 1980s, influenced by the psychology and popular culture of trauma, the left had abandoned solidarity across difference in favor of the meditation on an expression of suffering, a politics of feeling and resentment, of self and sensitivity. The right, if it didn't describe itself as engaging in identity politics, adopted the same model. The NRA, notably, cultivated the resentments and grievances of white men, feeding, in particular, both long-standing resentment of African Americans and newly repurposed resentment of immigrants. Together, both left and right adopted both a politics and a cultural style animated by indictment and indignation. A nation divided over guns and abortion bred a new generation of domestic terrorists. Between 1997 and 2001, anti-abortion activists, some affiliated with an organization called Operation Rescue, invaded 372 medical clinics that provided abortions, bombed 41 clinics, set 166 clinics on fire, and murdered 7 clinic staff, guards, and volunteers. Groups of white men purporting to defend the right to bear arms formed private militias. In Waco, Texas, in 1993, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms laid siege to a religious compound to seize illegal weapons, leading to the brutal deaths of 76 members of a sect headed by a man named David Koresh, including 25 children. 2 years later, Timothy McVeigh, who'd fought in the U.S. Army as an infantryman in Kuwait, blew up a federal building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people, including 15 babies and small children in a daycare center. McVeigh said he'd bombed the building in retaliation for the federal government's actions at Waco. 3 years before the bombing, he had written a letter to the editor of a small New York newspaper. "The American dream of the middle class has all but disappeared, substituted with people struggling just to buy next week's groceries," he wrote. "What is it going to take to open up the eyes of our elected officials? America is in serious decline." Meanwhile, the go-go 90s were boom times for dot-comers and hedge fund managers, for Hollywood moguls and global traders. Under Clinton, incomes rose across the board, but the middle class, especially the rural white middle class, really was in decline. What were the causes of that decline? Conservatives blamed liberals, liberals blamed conservatives. Conspiracy theorists blamed a nefarious government of elites. Oklahoma City and Waco launched the conservative talk radio host Alex Jones, who started a program called The Final Edition in 1996, on which he alleged that the government was behind the Oklahoma City bombing and that the Justice Department had set about to murder Koresh and his followers. Jones professed nonpartisanship. He said, "I don't care if it's Bill Clinton or Governor Bush. They're all elitist filth, if you ask me." Jones's lunatic conspiracy theories lay well outside ordinary political conversation. But the boundaries that separated ordinary political conversation from mayhem and incitement were crumbling. Both new ideas and new forms of political communication cultivated a growing intolerance for drifting political opinions and for differences more broadly. Left identity politics grew especially strong in the academy, where to disagree with the distinctive status of someone belonging to a particular identity group was to violate what conservatives, in an allusion to Stalinism, liked to deride as political correctness. In his 1987 Jeremiad, The Closing of the American Mind, University of Chicago literary critic Alan Bloom lamented the evisceration of truth. "There's one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering his university believes, or says he believes, that truth is relative." Veterans of the New Left lamented these developments, too. The squandering of energy on identity politics, the hardening of boundaries between groups, the insistence that individuals are no more than their labels is an American tragedy, Todd Gitlin wrote in 1995. Gitlin, who had been president of SDS in the 1960s, pointed out the irony of this tragedy. "The left, which once stood for universal values, seems to speak today for select identities, while the right, long associated with privileged interests, claims to defend the common good." The left's commitment to open debate unraveled. A no-platform movement, the turn during which the left started sounding like the right, was founded in 1974 by a British student group that prohibited providing a platform to anyone holding racist or fascist views. One influence was the German-born American intellectual Herbert Marcuse, who argued in a widely read essay that liberals' commitment to open debate was absurd because free speech had become a form of oppression. Another influence, beginning in the 1980s, was the field of trauma studies, which understood words as harm. By the early 1990s, mostly due to the influence of critical race theory, a theory of unequal speech advanced by black legal scholars, including Derrick Bell, more than 350 American colleges and universities adopted hate speech codes. Other black scholars objected. To be sure, blacks are still on the front lines of First Amendment jurisprudence, but this time, we soldier on the other side, Henry Louis Gates Jr. wrote ruefully in 1996. The byword among many black activists and black intellectuals is no longer the political imperative to protect free speech, it is the moral imperative to suppress hate speech. Campus hate speech codes were often used against the very people they were designed to protect. The suppression of hate speech, which a generation before had been the project of the FBI agents who investigated civil rights activists, became the work of the university. In less than 2 years under the University of Michigan speech code, more than 20 white students accused black students of racist speech. At nearly the same time, both the left and the right, unwilling to brook dissent, began dismantling structures that nurture fair-minded debate, the left undermining the university, the right undermining the press. In 1987, the Reagan administration finally succeeded in its long-sought repeal of the Fairness Doctrine after the president vetoed a congressional effort to block the repeal. The repeal meant that broadcasters operating with federal licenses had no obligation either to dedicate programming to the public interest or to represent opposing points of view. Along with the creation of national toll-free telephone numbers and the opening of the FM band, which meant that music stations largely abandoned AM, opening those stations for other programming, the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine made possible a new kind of conservative talk radio. In 1987, there were some 240 talk radio stations in the country. By 1992, there were 900. The best known among the talk radio hosts was the energetic Rush Limbaugh, who began broadcasting nationally on 56 stations in the summer of 1988. Limbaugh did not generally have guests. He ranted and he raved and he fielded phone calls from the public. Caustic and provocative, he gave vent to hatreds and resentments that had been considered unspeakable on the air. "He's saying what I think," listeners said. His popularity could be seen in bumper stickers that read, "Rush is right." Republican political strategist and television producer Roger Ailes met Limbaugh in 1990 and soon began producing a Limbaugh television show. And although it failed, it convinced Ailes to find a home for conservative television news. In 1992, when Ailes and Limbaugh together visited the White House, President Bush saw fit to carry Limbaugh's bag. Leon Baxter, who had died in 2001 at the age of 95, had worried about men like Ailes, whose early rise she witnessed. The Ohio-born Ailes had been working in television when he became an advisor to Richard Nixon in 1968. He soon moved from entertainment to politics, though what he pioneered was bringing the two together. Between 1980 and 1986, he'd aided the campaigns of 13 Republican senators and 8 members of Congress, including Phil Graham and Mitch McConnell. At the beginning of the age of talk radio and cable television, but a decade before the rise of the Internet and 20 years before social media, Ailes developed a new and prescient theory of communication, which he elaborated on in 1988 in the co-written book, You Are the Message. Ailes argued that polling, market research, and the television ratings industry demonstrated that the most saleable pitches are simple, instant, and emotional. This insight applied not only to detergents and sitcoms, but also to people. Remote controls for television had become commonplace in the late 1970s, just when cable programming was beginning. And viewers took to flipping through the channels. The term soundbite was coined in the 1970s, when, armed with a remote, viewers couldn't be counted on to catch much more than a sentence or a phrase before changing channels. "People are like television programs," Ailes explained. "A person has only 7 seconds to be likable before someone changes the channel. It's what I call the like factor," he wrote. The like factor, like the lie factory before it, came to drive American political communication, decades before the rise of Facebook with its likes. In effect, the like factor replaced the Fairness Doctrine. In a transformation long sought by conservatives, ratings trumped the public interest, a change that was perhaps first made evident in televised debates between presidential candidates. After the Kennedy-Nixon debates in 1960, no general election presidential debate had taken place for 16 years, until Ford agreed to debate Carter in 1976. Ford believed he had no choice but to agree, because after pardoning Nixon, he'd fallen 30 points behind in the all-important polls. In 1980, when John Anderson ran as an independent against Carter and Reagan, the League of Women Voters, which sponsored the debates, ruled that to participate in a general election, a candidate had to have earned at least 15% in a national poll. As even pollsters admitted, this was indefensible, since polls are simply not reliable enough to support that decision. Meanwhile, as part of its campaign to deregulate the FCC, the Reagan administration was determined to allow television broadcasters, rather than nonprofits, to sponsor the debates, notwithstanding a prophetic warning issued by the head of the League of Women Voters, Dorothy Ridings. She told a Senate committee that broadcasters keen for the highest ratings would pander both to the candidates and especially to the audience in an attempt to make the debates as zippy and as watchable as possible, without regard to whether or not they would help voters learn about either the candidates or the issues. As a result of that push, television broadcasters gained control of the primary debates, which grew more raucous, while sponsorship of the general election debates was taken over by a nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. The tone of the debates, though, was set by Ailes. He coached Reagan to disarm Mondale by promising not to make age an issue. "I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience," Reagan said. He calmed George H.W. Bush's nerves before his first 1988 debate against Michael Dukakis, who, as governor of Massachusetts, had supported the repeal of a state law that banned sodomy and bestiality. "If you get into trouble out there, just call him an animal fucker," Ailes whispered to Bush backstage. Even as Bush prepared to take the stage, that night's moderator, Texas-born television newsman Dan Rather, who styled himself in the mold of Edward R. Murrow, looked straight into the camera and apologized to his audience. "This will not be a debate in the sense the word is often used in the English language, because all of this is so tightly controlled by the candidates themselves and their managers." The League of Women Voters issued a press release denouncing the debates as a fraud on the American voter. But the debates only got worse. Ratings rose, and zingers got zippier. In 1992, the Bill Clinton campaign made sure the candidates were given very big stools so that Ross Perot would look like a child. Clinton, gregarious and charismatic and quick on his feet, loved a new town hall format in which the candidates took questions from the audience. Reserved New England-bred Bush did not. Caught on camera looking at his watch, Bush later admitted that he'd been thinking, "Only 10 more minutes of this crap." The fiercest indictment came from 74-year-old Walter Cronkite. "The debates are part of the unconscionable fraud that our political campaigns have become," Cronkite said in 1990. "Here is a means to present to the American people a rational exposition of the major issues that face the nation and alternative approaches to their solution. Yet the candidates participate only with the guarantee of a format that defies meaningful discourse. They should be charged with sabotaging the electoral process." Cronkite and other veterans of the golden age of television news lamented the new age, the rise of cable news. CNN, which provided news 24 hours a day, was launched in 1980 and posted its first profit by 1985. By 1990, it reached 53 million households, a number that only rose after 1991 with its on-the-ground, real-time coverage of the Persian Gulf War, a U.S.-led operation to push the Saddam Hussein-led Iraqi army out of neighboring Kuwait. MSNBC started in July 1996, followed later that year by Fox News, run by Ailes and owned by an Australian tabloid newspaper tycoon and notable conservative named Rupert Murdoch. The year before, Murdoch had funded a new conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard, published in Washington and co-edited by Bill Kristol. With funding for Murdoch, Ailes started Fox News from scratch. "We had no news-gathering operation," he later recalled. "We had no studios, no equipment, no employees, no stars, no talent. No confidence from anybody." Many found Ailes' venture surprising, since he had no background in journalism, and frequently said that he did not respect journalists. A news organization run by a political operative, a Republican kingmaker, would seem to violate basic standards of journalism. And yet Ailes insisted that Fox News aimed to rescue journalism. "We'd like to restore objectivity where we find it lacking," he said at a press conference. "We expect to do fine, balanced journalism." Liberals shuddered. Senior advisor to the president, George Stephanopoulos, asked why Bill Clinton, who had appeared on MSNBC on its opening day, would not do the same for Fox News, said, "Well, for one thing, MSNBC is not owned by Rupert Murdoch and run by Roger Ailes." But MSNBC was not less partisan than Fox News. It was merely differently partisan. Entrenched partisanship in cable news eroded the institutions of democratic deliberation. The rise of cable news accelerated the polarization first of Congress and then of the electorate. During the reign of broadcast television between 1950 and 1980, when there were only three major networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, polarization was the lowest it had ever been, both before and since. Cable news made voters more partisan by reinforcing their views and limiting their exposure to other views. But cable television had another effect, too. when the only channels on television were ABC, CBS, and NBC, and each network broadcast the news at 6:30 p.m., people who weren't particularly interested in politics, who tended to be moderates, had usually watched, and as a result, they tended to vote. Conservatives denounced broadcast news as liberal, but in fact it was pitched to the widest possible mass audience, made even-handedness its priority, and provided a political education to voters who had not previously been interested in politics. When cable stations offered choices aside from the news, people who weren't interested in the news watched something else and tended not to vote. The people least interested in politics and least partisan dropped out of the electorate. Meanwhile, the rise of round-the-clock cable news produced a veritable army of political commentators and pundits and gave office holders and office seekers nearly endless airtime, creating a political class of television celebrities. It created a high-profile blur of people on TV whose brands overtook their professional identities, wrote the New York Times' Mark Leibovitz. They were not journalists or strategists or pals per se, but citizens of the green room. They were pretty and handsome, and they looked alike, and they sounded alike too. They never said, "I don't know," or "Let me think about that." They scowled and flared their nostrils and attacked one another, cocks in a cockfight. The White House became a cockfight pit too. In 1995, Michael McCurry, Clinton's press secretary, began opening daily press briefings to televised coverage. The Clinton campaign was chronicled in the War Room and his White House, in a way, on West Wing. When people from Clinton's campaign and from his administration left politics, they made piles of money, hawking their access to policymakers. In the 2.5 years between when senior advisor Rahm Emanuel left the Clinton White House and when he ran for Congress, he pocketed more than $18 million, chiefly working for an investment banking firm. The opportunities for corruption and ethics violations were endless. The opportunities for ratings driven by scandal were limitless. In 1996, CNN had 60 million subscribers, MSNBC 25 million, and Fox 17 million. 2 years later, a news story broke that led to a 400% increase in Fox's primetime ratings. Watergate had inaugurated an era of politics by other means, where political opponents attempted, instead of defeating one another's arguments or winning elections, to oust each other from office by way of ethics investigations. Between 1970 and 1994, the number of federal indictments of public officials rose from virtually zero to more than 1,300. These often meaningless battles, waged in televised hearings, on television talk shows, and in the courts, brought down a great many politicians. They also eroded the public's faith in the institutions to which those politicians belonged, mainly Congress, the presidency, and the Supreme Court. In July 1995, Monica Lewinsky, a 21-year-old graduate of Oregon's Lewis and Clark College, started an internship at the White House. In November, the president began an affair with her that lasted 16 months and appears mainly to have involved her performing oral sex on him in or near the Oval Office. Allegedly, she later said that her title ought to have been Special Assistant to the President for Blowjobs. Other presidents had affairs. Most of those men, including FDR and JFK, had affairs in an era when the press tacitly agreed not to expose them. Clinton engaged in an affair with Lewinsky at a time when exposing politicians' affairs was the favored weapon of political battle. Not only that, but the nation was in the midst of a campaign against sexual harassment in the workplace. Clinton's foolishness, irresponsibility, and recklessness in this affair was difficult to fathom. He was the first Democratic president to assume office after the rise of right-wing radio. Millions of Americans heard him criticized daily for hours. Right-wing attacks on Clinton and his wife were relentless, whether the charges had merit or, more often, no merit at all. Limbaugh accused Hillary Clinton of covering up a murder, a rumor he read in a fax sent to his office. "That's what it said in the fax," Limbaugh said, defending slander. Whatever else presidents had done or not done, it was absurd in such circumstances for Clinton to believe he would get away with first the affair and second the cover-up. Clinton had been subjected to investigation from the moment he took office. Unrelated investigations into a land deal the Clintons had made in Arkansas involving Whitewater, a development on the White River, and into a civil suit filed by Paula Jones, a former Arkansas state employee, had been orchestrated by the Conservative Political Action Committee. Jones alleged that Bill Clinton had sexually harassed her in a hotel room in 1991. Beginning in 1994, these charges were investigated by Bush's former Solicitor General Kenneth Starr, appointed as an independent counsel. Jones, who alleged that Clinton had asked her to kiss his penis, purported to describe its distinguishing characteristics in a sworn affidavit. Jones represented conservatives working back after the Clarence Thomas hearings. The month her story broke, in March 1994, the nation's three major television news networks aired 126 stories about Whitewater. From January through March, they had aired 42 stories about the proposed health care plan. Critics despaired about a politics